I'm Dr. Steven Spielberg, Editor-in-Chief of Therapeutic Innovation and Regulatory Science, the Journal of the Drug Information Association. Welcome to our first podcast. Together with Sage Publishing, we're initiating a series of electronic communications to complement our journal with timely discussions of important topics. We have a new Associate Editor for Novel Communications, Dr. Eric Paraxlis, who will be helping evolve our approach to bringing information more broadly to our membership and to all who are interested in advancing human therapeutics and regulatory science around the world. With me today is Dr. Lota de Wolf of UCB in Brussels, Belgium. He's the author of a paper, Medicines in Pregnancy, Women and Children First, Time for a Coalition to Address a Substantial Patient Need, that was published in the September 2013 issue of Tears. Dr. de Wolf, could you please tell us a bit about your background and why you became interested in the area of maternal health and therapy?
Hello, Stephen. Thanks for having me. Well, I was trained as a family practitioner or general physician in both Belgium and South Africa. And then I practiced a bit before entering the pharmaceutical industry as long ago as 1989. And since then, I've been mostly working in the medical affairs area. And this, of course, includes other dimensions such as pharmacovigilance, clinical development, health economics, and also regulatory affairs. And throughout both my clinical and my pharmaceutical career, I've always been fascinated by the power of education, which I think is as important as medicines in bringing better solutions to those people living with a disease. This is, for example, why in 1999, I was co-founder of Europe's first healthcare information portal, because for the first time the internet came along, it is possible to reach almost anyone with good medical information. Unfortunately, our company was a little bit too early and we didn't make it. But I learned a lot from that experience, and I never lost my passion for education and for new media such as the internet and podcasts as a tool to educate. In the last 2 years, I've had several personal experiences that made me wake up to this huge issue of medication and pregnancy, which had been hidden and still is largely hidden in our plain sight. There were a few stories of pregnant women who I know personally who got refused care or were getting really unhelpful advice. And there was also the reaction, both by clinicians and also regulators, to some pregnancy-related data that we discovered in my company.
You know, it's interesting. In recent years, I think we've all become increasingly aware of the need for broad input from patients themselves, their physicians, patient advocacy groups, as well as pharmaceutical companies and regulators in therapeutic decision-making.
Absolutely right, because it truly is through listening to the stakeholders, to patients, physicians, and also regulators, that I personally became deeply aware of this huge issue which had been ignored for so long. Although I must admit that perhaps the most impactful experience that triggered me was to learn about how one man, who's Professor Frederik Amand of the Leuven University in Belgium, broke and changed the paradigm of cancer in pregnancy and its treatment. I don't know if you know, but 1 in 1,000 women is diagnosed with cancer during her pregnancy, not before, not after, but during. And they've always been, and in many places still are, routinely refused therapy because they're pregnant. So they are advised to either abort the baby or to hang on to the baby and not get treated until an early, usually premature cesarean section can be done. And that horror choice really hit me very, very deep. And Professor Mann was the same, but by doing a very simple but well-designed observational study, he was able to show that taboo, which was quite logic, but the taboo on the use of anti-cancer drugs in pregnancy, and this was based on the absence of data, was totally unjustified. And as a result of that single study, in less than 2 years, the guidelines of the European Society of Gynecology changed, and they now offer real support and treatment for women in this horrible situation. So I really thought, you know, if one man can drive such an important change for patients in such a serious pathology, then surely I, with the support of my company, must be able to do the same in other fields. because this issue is truly global. It's present across all areas of health, including medicine and dentistry.
Interesting. Can you briefly define for us the extent of the problem and some of the clinical challenges the pregnant patients and their physicians face?
Yes. As I said, it's a really huge problem, and it's a global problem because it goes across countries, it grows across all therapy areas, and therefore also all medicine classes, which effectively means it impacts all of us. Because, you know, almost all medications, no matter which class, are contraindicated in pregnancy. And yet we know for a fact from epidemiological studies, including by the CDC, that up to 90% of women actually take medicines during their pregnancy. Not one, but on average three or four. Which means that these women are making these decisions basically on their own. Because when there are no data, there's no data sheet to help them, and there's very inconsistent advice from the internet. And that is probably the biggest problem, the disconnect and being alone in the middle of contrasting advice.
Now, there are a number of situations where pregnant women do take medicines. Can you tell us what sorts of circumstances lead to therapy in pregnancy?
Yeah, the most logic, of course, is the fact that when you're pregnant, you may have the symptoms and complications of pregnancy. You know, pregnancy can give you symptoms that become so bothersome that you really need some relief. Or you can have a complication like at the end of the pregnancy, and you really need an intervention even to save the baby and the mom. So we know that, and that's actually the area where we know most about the drugs. But the main reason why expecting mothers become patients is actually life itself. Because no matter how blissful a situation and condition pregnancy is, we're not protected from the hazards of life, like infections, accidents, which happen at home and at work and are the number one cause of medications, and things like I mentioned, cancer. So those are the two reasons, the pregnancy itself and life.
And we're also seeing a change in demographics with advancing age of women at the time that they do become pregnant, and patients with chronic illness as well who wish to have a child and do indeed become pregnant.
Yes, and this is a relatively new group, I would say, which is probably even we know less about, and it's growing. Because exactly as you said, because women get older, and in many countries that means that the first pregnancy occurs at or after the age of 30. And for example, my wife and I, we were in our mid-30s when we had our first. When you get older, you have a bigger chance of already having developed a chronic condition. For example, hypertension, which 2012 statistics from the USA is diagnosed before pregnancy in almost 10%. And almost all 10% other group of pregnant women is diagnosed with diabetes before getting pregnant. And over 10%, actually 12-13, with depression. And that's just three diseases. So as you grow older, you have a high likelihood of having a disease. And because medicine has advanced in recent decades, that disease today is more likely to be diagnosed and treated. Because we learned that for these chronic conditions, the earlier you catch the disease and treat it, the long-term outcome is better. And so that is the main reason, advancing age and advancing medicine. And there's a last group which we cannot forget, which is also a result of advancing medicine, and that's the so-called survivors. When I was a kid, I lost a good friend to bone cancer. And this disease, which happens quite frequently in kids, like leukemia and like other diseases, used to have a very high mortality. But today it doesn't anymore, which means that these people become adults, they want children, but they are often survived thanks to very powerful drugs, sometimes drugs they need to continue taking for the rest of their life, and we really don't know very well what it does for their parenthood. And so that's why this latter group, patients becoming pregnant, will continue to increase and why we have to address this issue.
Can you elaborate on some areas of research, both basic and pharmacovigilance, and how that affects regulatory challenges in this realm?
Yeah, I think the biggest challenge is the one of disconnect. Because many, many people and researchers and regulators, they really, really do care about this issue. And some have already devoted their career to the issue. But in my view, one of the reasons why, in spite of all those fantastic initiatives, we haven't really fundamentally solved the issue is because of the isolation of those initiatives. And we can't all blame it on academic pressure. It may be a contributor, but that's not all of it. We simply lack a common language when we deal with this issue. We have no research standards, neither to what we should measure, how long we should measure, or how we should report and analyze it. Now, some companies, big ones, have already been able to create internal standards for themselves, which is great. But then those are, again, different from other companies. So we really need to go beyond these individual initiatives, because we will only find the solutions if we find this common language, these standards that apply across countries, which means regulators, but also across companies and academic institutions, which really means we have a lot of work to do and a lot of hurdles to overcome. So I really think the first issue is one of disconnect within the scientific world, which I always take to include academia, industry, and regulators. And the second big issue, in my view, is another disconnect, and that's between the scientific world on the one side and the first line. Because a lot of great work that has been done is simply not reaching the first line. Too much insights remain stuck in high-level scientific journals, and the only thing that seems to filter through are panic signals, sometimes picked up by journalists and then put into a newspaper article, but they're not helpful. Somehow, it seems to me that the medical world has forgotten that it has a duty to educate, not just to look for answers.
Can you share with us some of your thoughts on how to advance knowledge and, as you said, is equally important to disseminate that information, really to translate it into action on behalf of women?
Yeah, I think we have to repair that disconnect, because today, because there's a disconnect with the medical community, people actually try to find the information on the internet. And although there's a lot of good stuff on the internet, there's also a lot of bad medical information. A recent survey from the FDA found that a quarter of all the websites have information about a particular drug that was simply the opposite. So one said, don't take whatever you do, and the other one said, that's the one you should take. And so the internet today is not a solution. And I believe still that the internet can be a solution, but it will mean that we would need to create a single and qualified information source, one that stands above the individual institutions, because some of them do have a few sentences on their web pages or physician associations, but it really should be backed up by the combined medical and scientific power of those who know the data. My dream would be to have this information resource co-founded and endorsed by academia, industry, and regulators, because for me, I really think it's the only way to solve the problem, because then people know this is the place to go to, and everybody goes to the same place. And of course, it can't solve all the individual cases, but I'm pretty sure it will solve most of the problems. And for the rest, we always need to make sure that people can have individual access to and advice from recognized clinicians in centers of expertise. We can't expect all physicians and all dentists to really know about this special situation, but we should all be knowing who does and send our patients there.
Can you suggest some ways that the DIA, our meetings and activities, together with our journals, can help play a role in this goal?
I think that the DIA has a unique role. As I said at the beginning, this is a global problem that goes across all therapy areas, and it goes across regulators, industry, etc. The DIA truly is the only neutral, global, not-for-profit platform that exists to have these debates. And so I think it's absolutely fantastic that the DIA has recognized this huge public health issue and has decided to not remain passive but to engage. They are now committed to providing that much-needed neutral platform where people can meet and have the difficult discussions and ask the difficult questions and start working toward a solution. And it'll take time, because we shouldn't fool ourselves. This similar situation existed for children not too long ago, and it took over 10 years of discussions and work to get it fixed. It will also take a few years for pregnancy, but with the DIA now engaged, I am more confident than ever that it will happen.
Dr. DeWolf, thanks so much for your insights into this tremendously important area that really, as you say, impacts all of us. This concludes our podcast today. For more information on this subject and to view Dr. Wolf's article, please visit our website, tirs.sagepub.com.